Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this week's episode of Kicking It With Raphael. Three great guests on the show today. Maybe four. We'll see what happens. We're not sure if Mark will be able to make the show today. But we have a great guest out of London right now. And most of our guests today are going to be out of London. But we're going to start off with ESPN's and Bleacher Report's James McNichols. James, welcome to the program.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of great things have been going on in the EPL. It's been one of those interesting kind of seasons where you kind of shake your head at what's going on. The first thing I wanted to discuss is let's go from the bottom to the top, which I think is more fun. Most people do it the opposite way, so we're going to do it this way. Sunderland right now, coming off a massive, massive win in the Derby. This has been a popular question on the show last month. Do you think they have enough pieces to stay? Do you think they're going to get relegated, or do you think that their new manager and all the players they have, because I think they have some nice names, but I want to know your thoughts on what you expect from this team in the next, you know, 6, 7, 8 months.
Well, I think I agree with you that there's some really talented players in there. And, you know, they did a lot of business this summer. You know, I like Altidore, who's coming up front. I like some of the, you know, I like Jaccarini as well. He's a very good player. But if you actually look at the team that they've played in the last couple of games under Poyet, they've predominantly used players who were already there last season. You know, in the match at Hull this weekend, Jaccarini didn't even make the team, which tells you about, you know, how they've sort of tried to go back to basics, tried to go back to the players who were there you know, previously, because the change over the summer was just so high. And having had that sort of positive win in the Derby, as you say, against Newcastle, they would have gone to Hull with really high hopes. You know, Hull, a team who they would expect to be in the mix for relegation as well, probably come the end of the season. And to lose in the way they did, with two really irresponsible red cards, you know, both very foolish tackles in the circumstances, they really let the team down. It's a massive blow to them, and I think they are going to struggle. You know, if I was them, I probably would have appointed a manager who had more Premier League experience than Gus Poyet, who, although talented, has never managed at this level before. And if I had to put money on it, I'd say that at the moment, I think it's going to be very difficult for them to get out of trouble.
Interesting. Okay, yeah. Poyet, of course, was with Brighton for, I think, 4 or 5 years and was very solid, but never, you know, spectacular.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, also it's a big step up. You know, he did well in League One and he did well in the Championship, but it's coming to the Premier League, you know, it's such a different environment. And while I do think he's a good coach, I just wonder if this might be a huge task for him. And maybe the part of the reason the appointment was made was because he's got such a good record in the Championship. If Sunderland do go down, he might be a great guy to help bring them back up.
So this show is based out of the United States. Even you are in London, I'm in Israel. This show is based out of California. So a lot of people who are listening, I want to know, what is up with Jozy Altidore? You know, he has been a complete, I don't know, what's the right word? I don't offend our American friends, but he's been a disappointment. I've watched, I've watched 5 or 6 Sunderland matches this year, and there's times where you almost forget that he is on the pitch. There are times that you wonder, you know, why he is playing. Obviously, it's because of the money they spend on him and the, you know, the investment they gave up for him. But what do you think is going on with him? Last year, dominated in Netherlands, had 30 goals in the season. His team won the Dutch Cup. They're playing in Europe right now. What exactly can you try and explain maybe why he is struggling to really perform?
The first sort of caveat I'd add is that we've seen a lot of players in the past who've performed very well in the Netherlands, come to England and not quite replicated that form. You know, I'm thinking of guys like Afonso Alves, who broke a lot of goal scoring records and then came to Middlesbrough and was a big flop. I'm thinking of Mateo Kesman, who was, you know, very prolific at PSV but never quite the same at Chelsea. So I do think it's a league in which Brian Ruiz scored a lot of goals over there and hasn't replicated that in London with Fulham. So I do think it's a league where, you know, strikers can flourish more necessarily than they do in the Premier League. That said, I really like Altidore, as I said, and I watched him against Arsenal earlier in the season, and he was, you know, he was a monster. He's so physically powerful, so quick, so strong. But I think the primary problem Sunderland are having is that, you know, they're not used to supplying a striker like him, and they play with Stephen Fletcher as their figurehead a lot of the time. And I think that Altidore is slightly suffering by comparison. And I think that he's the sort of player who, because he gives you a lot with his back to goal, he can hold the ball up well. I think it's about developing that understanding with the midfield, and with so much constant rotation among the players at Sunderland, so many new players coming in. I just don't think that's settled yet. I wouldn't give up hope on him just yet, but it's certainly taking time for him to adapt back to the Premier League, that's for sure.
Yeah, I agree. The physical part, he's absolutely a monster, and watching him, you know, when he gets marked by defenders, you can tell he sometimes out physicalizes them. I don't know if that's an English word, but I just said
it. Yeah, out-muscled.
Out-muscled, right, there we go, thank you. Okay, interesting. So you still think, let's give him a little more time, but you did mention some guys who have struggled to make the move. Then you could talk about, you know, a guy like Suarez who's done fine, but, you know, Suarez
is
world-class talent, so I'm not really sure if he's a great comparison. Let's move on, though. Really historic moment yesterday, and very exciting for me to watch, the Welsh Derby. And in Israel, the derbies are very big because we have, you know, a lot of history. I guess in every country, a derby is big. But, sure. You know, in Israel, it's a lot about the politics here, you know, the left wing and the right wing. So to me, it was very moving to get to watch two teams from Wales play, two teams that aren't necessarily doing – actually, I guess Swansea, you could say, has been doing really well, and they play in Europe and so on. But can you tell me what it was like in London, how people kind of viewed this match? Was this just an ordinary – you know, the only match on Sunday afternoon, or was this something that people in London appreciated and said, wow, we have two teams from Wales playing, this is amazing? And be honest.
I think it was a much bigger deal to, you know, people from Wales, simply because for them, you know, Cardiff and Swansea a few years ago were both languishing in the lower divisions. And for them, you know, a lot of people never thought they would see this happen in the Premier League. You know, there've been plenty of derbies over the year, but never at this level. And it's fantastic for them that those two clubs have fought their way into the top division. You know, Swansea in particular were on the verge of dropping out of, you know, the full-time leagues altogether. They were right down the bottom, and they've had an extraordinary rise. In London, you know, you're probably right in that the attitude was probably a little less fervent. Simply because we have a lot of derbies of our own. You know, there's so many London clubs doing well in the Premier League these days. We seem to have a derby every week here. But this one was a bit special, and a lot of people I know tuned into it just because it was the first, you know, the first time we had the Welsh derby in the Premier League. And it was a really interesting game. Very tight, very passionate. And Cardiff, you know, you could tell it meant everything to them, and I feel like that contributed to the result at the end of the day.
Yeah, and I mean, they haven't really had the best season, so it was interesting for them to get the 1-0 victory. Let's move on now. Fulham right now are really struggling. There's been a lot of reports that they might be making some changes. You know, United has not had the most spectacular season, and they seem to rejuvenate their season this past weekend. Do you think that it is time to make changes at Fulham? I mean, is this also, let me add a part two to that question. We're seeing now reports in the U.S. actually that they're going to try and get Clint Dempsey to come back to them in January. So I guess the first question is, do they need to make changes, and is a guy like Clint Dempsey really going to, you know, turn things around for this team? You know, some people would argue yes, but let's get your thoughts.
Well, I think it does look a little bit bleak for Martin. You know, I mean, Shane Carn's been very supportive of him publicly, but the results aren't great. You know, the United result, it was the manner of the defeat as much as anything. You know, losing to Manchester United is no shame, but to be 3-0 down as quickly as they were suggested a team who just weren't really competing. And this comes after they conceded 4 goals to Leicester in midweek in the Capital One Cup and went out of that competition. So it's now 3 defeats on the bounce for them. You know, previous stat, they beat Crystal Palace, but who doesn't?
Right.
And I think that, you know, things don't look good. I mean, it's an odd team that Martin Bielsa assembled. He signed so many players with lots of attacking talent, loads of flair, but they seem to lack the sort of basic organisation and workmanlike qualities that you associate with a mid-table Premier League team. You know, I think I admire his footballing principles, but I'm not sure how practical they are. And I think that, you know, if they are going to, if Yol does stay on and he does get January, as much as I like Clint Dempsey, I'm not sure he's what they need. I feel like they need to, you know, improve their defence, maybe add some more stability to the midfield, rather than signing yet more attacking players, which seems to be what they have an overload of at the moment.
A bunch of Americans just booed you all the way in America for that comment.
I know. Well, he's a good player, and I was really shocked. And this is with, you know, I mean, obviously there's an implied disrespect to the MLS, which I don't mean at all, but I was really shocked when he left the Premier League this summer.
Yeah, that was amazing.
Yeah, very, very surprising to me, because he did well last year as well at Tottenham, and it wouldn't surprise me at all to see some EPL clubs come back in for him. I just think there are people who need him more than Fulham. I think he's not quite what they're looking for this time.
Agreed. I actually agree with you on that. Whatever. We won't get into my thoughts about him. Moving up, we're getting closer up to the top. So let's talk about United right now. We just spoke about their victory, and I think through 22 minutes they were up 3-0. Mm-hmm. Then it seemed like they kind of took a break. If not a break, but okay, we're gonna win this. They kind of took a step back, but still, you know, 3 points at this conjuncture is pretty good considering we've seen them have to come back. With Van Persie and Rooney scoring, what exactly is the problem? Is it the midfield? I mean, is the midfield just too much of a mess? Is the talent not there? I mean, I know a lot of these guys play for the English national team, but does that mean anything anymore? No disrespect to you. But, you know, this has been a very popular topic on every show in the world. But I don't know. I really am trying to understand it, because you look at the talent on the team, and it's just as, you know, good as pretty much any team. So what exactly is the struggle? Is it they're not, you know, are they not adapting to Moyes' style? Is it they don't, you know, respect Moyes? Is it that it's just taking time? I mean, what exactly is going on?
Well, it is difficult because, you know, as you say, they're the champions. You know, there's hard to find logical explanations. It's very much the same team that won this league relatively comfortably last season. I mean, the first thing I'd say is it seems like there's, you know, some positive momentum generating now. They have won their last four. They're undefeated in something like, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 now. So they are starting to get things together. But I think there are two factors that explain their slow start. One is the psychological factor of adjusting to life without Sir Alex Ferguson. I think that, you know, implicitly there was a kind of the sheer fear, I think, of that manager, I think, often generated performances from United. You know, I feel like he was such a master of motivation, and I feel like that chemistry with Moyes probably will take some time to develop. But I do think that, speaking more practically about matters on the pitch, I do think the central midfield is a bit of a problem. You know, they won well this weekend, but the £28 million midfielder who they signed, Marouane Fellaini, was started on the substitutes bench, you know. And they went with Phil Jones, who's ostensibly more of a defender, and Tom Cleverley, who's been out of sorts this season. So I think, you know, that's the area that they tried to improve in the summer. They tried to bring in guys like Cesc Fabregas, Nando Herrera. And I think when January comes around, that will be a real focus for them again. The question will be, who can they get in that time period? Who's available? But I feel like they need someone who gives them more fluidity in the centre of the park alongside Michael Carrick. And I think, you know, Fellaini's going through a difficult period and, to be honest, has failed to settle. So if they can get someone in that position, I think that, you know, they'll be there or thereabouts come back.
All right, and I gotta ask, what is up with Kagawa just not seeing any love? I mean, I've loved this player since way back in the days in Germany. He's always been really fun to watch, and in the World Cup, him and Honda, they're, you know, a very exciting dynamic duo for Japan. I don't understand why he's not playing. I think when he does play, he's been fantastic. Same you could argue with Chicharito. We saw this last year also, though, with Sir Alex. He didn't like to play him except for, you know, in that 70-minute mark. Then somehow he'd come in, score a goal, and that wouldn't be enough for him to start. Those two guys, what do you think their future is with the club? I mean, we've both seen reports out of Mexico and Japan that they're kind of getting fed up with not seeing playing time.
Yeah, and you can read into it as much as you like, but Javier Hernandez retweeted a news article the other day about, you know, how he might become unhappy if he doesn't play enough. So I wonder if there was a little message contained in there.
Interesting.
I mean, okay. He's a superb striker, and it, you know, at any other club in the EPL, he would be a first choice. You know, in many ways, you know, when had Alex Ferguson stayed on, you feel like he would have sold Wayne Rooney, and I think that could have been Hernandez's moment, you know, to sort of supersede expectations and become United's, you know, top man alongside Robin van Persie. As it happened, Ferguson retired, Moyes came in, and Rooney stayed, and that means Hernandez is on the substitutes bench. And I think that, you know, he's got to make a decision, really. It reminds me of the predicament that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer faced a little while ago when he was Manchester United's super sub, you know, this superb finisher. And he, you know, he had opportunities to move elsewhere. The likes of Tottenham were interested, who are a club who've been mentioned in relation to Chicharito. And he chose to stay at United and pick up the trophies. And although he never really, you know, got the first team opportunities he deserved, he did partake in a lot of glory. So that's the dilemma Hernandez faces. It's going to be interesting to see what he does, but I think for this season at least, he'll certainly stick it out and see how things go. With Kagawa, I feel like it's to do with the United system, really. I feel like Moyes is too conservative to play Kagawa in the middle of a midfield four. It's only when he goes for something more like a five and there's a room for a true number 10 that Kagawa gets a look in. And that means not playing one of Robin van Persie and Wayne Rooney. And at the moment, those two are on fire. So the only chance Kagawa's going to get is probably on the flank. And it seems that they're very keen to develop Januzaj in that position at the moment. So I do feel for Kagawa. I feel like his primary problem is that, you know, he's a bit of a square peg in a round hole. He doesn't fit quite with the United system, which is unfortunate because I agree with you that to watch, he's a fantastic player.
Yeah, what's interesting as well is that Hernandez now, Mexico has that really important playoff against New Zealand, and their new manager, who's their, fourth manager in the last 6 weeks, decided not to to have anyone play who doesn't play domestically in Mexico. So he's not going to be a part of that team that, you know, attempting to qualify for the World Cup. And if you read some interviews, it just straight up says, you know, he's not getting minutes at United. You know, New Zealand's not the best team in the world, but we have not been a good team in this campaign, and I can't take the risk of playing a guy who's, you know, sometimes playing 20 minutes, sometimes not playing. So that's why he wasn't invited, and everyone on the Mexican team plays domestically. And the funny part is pretty much everyone on the team, I think, is the coaches. It's the coach was on one of the top teams in Mexico, and then he left at the last second to be the head coach, but he took all the players from his team to be the coach. Whatever, that's another story that we could get into. We're going to finish with Arsenal because we have to with you. And we're going to continue the EPL talk with your ESPN colleague, which I'm hoping you can tell me how to pronounce his last name. Christian Hinaj?
I think that's right.
Okay.
I think that's right.
So he's going to be coming on after you, and he's going to continue the talk but more with Chelsea, Spurs, Liverpool, City, and Southampton. But with you, we'll finish with Arsenal sitting 5 points on top, looking great, smiling, happy. Everything's wonderful. Hooray, hooray. But is that really how it is? I want to ask you that. Is that really how you view it? Do you really think that this team has all the pieces to compete for a title with all the, you know, just things that happen in Arsenal over the years? I mean, I don't want to get into it, but you know, and everyone who's listening knows. So is this team strong enough to have this kind of point record in 4 months or in 5 months? Or are we going to see, you know, City really is starting to play better and United and Liverpool, not even Liverpool, excuse me, Chelsea battle them?
I think, you know, on their day, all those teams that you mentioned are stronger than this Arsenal team.
Right.
I think, you know, if you watch Manchester City blow away Norwich, you see a, you know, extraordinary team there. If you watch Chelsea play under Mourinho, some of that rapid counter-attacking, Manchester United when Rooney and Van Persie are firing, I feel like the potential in those teams is probably greater than what there is within the Arsenal squad at the moment. However, what Arsenal have is consistency. You know, since the turn of this year, this calendar year, there hasn't been a better team in the Premier League results-wise than Arsenal. They've been on a fantastic run, and that's carried over into this season. And I feel like that's what's presented Arsenal with this opportunity. The inconsistency of other teams, the periods of adaptation that they're all going through, has allowed Arsenal to take advantage. Now, they still deserve plenty of credit. You know, they've definitely improved, and they're showing a sort of real determination and a real focus to get these Premier League points. What will be really interesting, of course, is their run of games coming up. You know, they travel to Dortmund, but then they face Manchester United at Old Trafford. And if they go to Manchester United and get a positive result, I feel like that will be truly transformative. I feel like at the moment, everybody's still very cautious. Everybody's still saying, well, it's early days. Arsene Wenger's very hesitant to, you know, announce Arsenal as title challengers at this stage. But if they can go to Old Trafford and come back with something, then I think we might have to take them very seriously as possible winners.
And then, of course, there'll be the international break. And then they'll be up against a Southampton team that's suddenly very dangerous. We've seen them play well against all the top teams. So do you mark that match as...
a difficult one, yes. No doubt. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, this month of November was always sort of seen as the defining month for this season. And you can look at it one of two ways. I mean, you know, people were very up after the Liverpool win and, you know, happy to sort of be 5 points clear at the top of the table. But we've also lost home games against Dortmund and Chelsea in the cup competitions.
Right.
So you can put a spin on it either way, really. I mean, I think that the thing is that the focus of the Arsenal fans and almost the team, you feel, is so strongly on the Premier League because they sense an opportunity there that those cup results sort of fade into insignificance slightly. And even this Dortmund trip, I mean, even if Arsenal were to go out of the Champions League, it would be a huge blow. But if they won at Old Trafford, I feel like it would be countered. You know, I feel like Arsenal sense that the opportunity for them to succeed this season is in the EPL, and that's where their focus is going to be. So I do think that Old Trafford game is a massive one. The Southampton one, if they go into that on the back of a positive result against Manchester United, I think they'll feel confident. If they lose heavily at Manchester United, that suddenly becomes, as you say, a real banana skin, because Southampton are one of the league's surprise teams this season. They've been superb. So all in all, I do feel like it's... maybe I'm being a bit chicken, maybe I'm sitting on the fence, but I feel like after next week, we'll have a much clearer idea. I think what we did learn this week is maybe that Liverpool aren't quite title challengers. You know, the way they were dispatched by Arsenal suggests that they have a little bit of improvement to go before they're at that level.
That being said, James, do you believe that Wenger should he start his top team in against Dortmund? I mean, away in Germany, or should he, you know, rest some of the guys for United? Because it's if that's really, I mean, I know that he can never publicly say our goal is not to win the Champions League, it is to...
Sure.
But there's a way of showing it without declaring it, if you know what I mean. So do you think that we're going to see very different, you know, starting 11s for the Dortmund match on the 6th and then for the United match on the 10th, which the 6th is this Wednesday and the 10th is this Sunday? That's, you know, that's 3 days that flying to Germany and you get back early Thursday morning and suddenly Sunday afternoon you're playing. So do you think we're going to see the same two starting 11s?
I think we will see the same. And I think that the reason for that is simply because there isn't much choice. You know, it looks like we'll lose Jack Wilshere to an injury. It looks like we'll lose Kieran Gibbs. You've still got the likes of Flamini, Podolski, Chamberlain, Walcott, all on the sidelines. So there isn't actually that much opportunity to rotate. If there was, then I agree, Arsene Wenger might face a choice, although I feel like he personally is very obsessed by the Champions League and it's a competition that means a lot to him, so he'd be loath to prioritise it that way. I think what they'll do is they'll use the same kind of 11 for both games and just see it as, you know, if we can just get to the international break, hopefully after that we should have, you know, a few players coming back. You'd hope, at least. And then Arsenal could sort of go into the Southampton game with a rejuvenated, refreshed squad
Right, and for the most part, I don't think most Arsenal players will not be playing in that international break just because it's, well, I'm trying to think off the top of my head, but are any of the Arsenal players playing in European?
In the playoffs?
Yeah, I'm trying to
there's
think.
There's a few. France are obviously in the playoffs, so that'll be Giroud, Sanya Koscielny.
Right.
But a lot of the other nations have arranged international friendlies.
Ah, of course.
So, you know, England played Germany and Chile, I think. So a lot of the players will go away, but fortunately most of the matches aren't competitive.
Right.
France, I think, are the main one who face a competitive tie, and obviously Arsenal will be praying that Giroud comes through that unscathed.
Yes, absolutely. Big stuff there against Ukraine. All right, we got to run, but it was absolutely a pleasure to have you on, and it'd be really great to have you on again throughout the season. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks, man. I hope to be back.
And before you go, though, tell people where they can check out your work on ESPN and Bleacher Report, and give a Twitter handle that you'd like people to follow you on.
Cool. Well, look, there's two Twitter handles, really. If you want to follow sort of my more general stuff, it's at James McNicholas. Alternatively, if you want sort of more Arsenal-specific stuff, I'm on at GunnerBlog. If you head over to Bleacher Report or ESPN, you'll find me there.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Enjoy. I guess Champions League is starting tomorrow. Good luck on Wednesday, and we'll be in touch later in the year. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Rafael. Bye.
All right. So that was James McNichols. James works for ESPN, and we spoke about the EPL. Very exciting stuff. After our next guest, our third guest of the day, we'll finish off the EPL top, talking Chelsea, Liverpool, City, and even Southampton. But before that, it's a pleasure to welcome on Diederik Ottesen, who works for a new company that I just recently discovered, and I must say I'm now in love with. That's Football Radar. Everyone should check them out on Twitter and check out all their analysts, because it's a wonderful thing, and it's been great having these guys on the show. So welcome to the show, Diederik.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And, you know, I wanted to have you on because you cover the Belgian league, the Pro League, the First Division, and everyone in the world right now is really high on the Belgian national team. And everyone is discussing that, you know, in media. But people don't realize that all these guys that we see that are starring in bigger clubs, they started somewhere. And where did they start? They started in the Belgian League. So today I kind of wanted to do a nice segment for you to teach us more about the Belgian League, and then hopefully we could have you on later in the year and we can actually, you know, maybe dissect and analyze the league more. But this is kind of just a interesting league. So I wanted to ask you the first question. What kind of level of competition is the Belgian league? I mean, would you rate it in the top 10 in European play? Is it come right after, you know, the big, you know, five, England, Spain, Germany, Netherlands? What kind of level is this Belgian league? I mean, we have very good teams that we see in the Champions League and in Europa League, but how would you rate it?
Well, I think what is quite ideal with the Belgian league is how the level is sort of just below the top ones, meaning that the young guys can easily play and sort of get to know the level and play on a still a reasonably high level and get experience from Europe without having the instant pressure of being in a top league. So there are people coming like 16, 17 year olds still learning the ropes, still learning the game, and have to gain experience before they can actually develop into top players in top leagues. So it's, I would say sort of just below the standard of the best leagues in Europe. And we've seen that this year as well. There are some very, very exciting young players coming in. Some even born in 1997, which is ridiculous.
Wow.
And they are taking, like they are learning in every game, and they are still developing. And that's why it's quite handy for them to be in a league where the level is still good, the level of technique, physical level is still good without it being incredibly high paced, let's say like the English Premiership or the German Bundesliga.
Interesting. And I've been watching it a lot lately because we get the feeds in Israel because one of our crazy managers, Nuzon, is now in Standard And it's been fun to watch that. Every week we get every game because it's a big deal when Israelis play abroad. And, of course, we also have Lior Rafaelov, who's playing in Belgium. But the next question is all these guys, Hazard, I mean, I could just keep naming all these stars that we see right now that are playing all across Europe, and everyone knows the name, so there's no need for me to mention them. But when they started in Belgium, did they start at age 16, 17? I mean, is this what we saw?
Yeah, pretty much. You saw players coming through at 16, 17 and being given an 18 and 19 and being given the chance to play regularly, week in and week out. And, you know, that's how you develop as a player. That's how youngsters, you know, develop. They learn by playing, not necessarily just by training. So, that's what we see the fruits of now. Most of the big players in the Belgium national team, they have played together since they finished third in the 2008 Beijing Olympics. Like Hazard, Dembele, Fellaini, all of those players have played together on the national since then. So they know each other well. And obviously have developed together in a way. And that's what basically we see the fruits of now in the Belgian national team, how these players have, they know each other well and they've played together for a long time.
Would you say that, I mean, as a guy who covers the league professionally, and I'm sure you follow the Belgians who play in all the other leagues, would you say that the hype is justified, Didrik? Do you think that, you know, the talk of them going as far as the semifinals or really being a team ready to come on top and tell the world, you know, we're ready to really be a world powerhouse? Do you buy that, or do you still think that these guys who are 22 and 23 still need time? Because at one, you know, one way you look at it is, hey, they've been playing, you know, top-tier football, as you're saying, since they were 16, 17. So they may be 22, but they've been playing 5 years in a good league. So, you know, I'm very curious. We've heard all the, you know, experts who don't really pay attention to this league as much as you do. So it's, like I said, I'm very happy that you're on the show, because we really are going to listen to your opinion and actually say, okay, this guy knows what he's talking about. So what do you think? I mean, is this team ready to really, really make a stand in this World Cup?
Well, I think they definitely still have things to learn, and they're still learning, as you said, at 22, 23. But also, I think it's important what you pointed out, that these players have been playing football since they were 16, 17, 18 on a high level. So they have experience despite being young. And I definitely think they have one of the biggest challenges the manager has, is maybe to fit all the players that are expected to feature, maybe to fit them into the high-paced, sort of flexible 4-3-3 system that they're playing, and to get to utilise everyone in the most ideal way. Like, they've been playing Vertonghen at left back, for example, which we all know his preferred position is probably centre-back. They are still not quite sure where to play Hazard, because he drifts in when he's on the wing. But if he plays in centre midfield, you have to drop either Dembele, Fitz, or Fellaini. So they have a bit of a luxury problem, which could be maybe their biggest challenge, how to fit all the big names who are playing regularly for the big clubs in, like, Premiership and Germany and so on, and fit them into a working system where they get to utilize their skills the best.
Right. And, yeah, I mean, I've actually, you know, been saying on the show that I think Switzerland is a really team that people are not paying attention to. It was fun watching them in World Cup qualifying, but these two teams, Belgium and Switzerland, really exciting. Let's talk. I've been enjoying following your Twitter feed. We know Hazard has a little brother. Eden Hazard has a little brother. Can you talk a little bit about him? Is he a guy that you expect to also make the transition to a bigger club?
Yeah, definitely. He's on loan from Chelsea this year, and he's been absolutely dominant for Salta in the UPL League this year. I mean, born in 1993 as well. He's very young, but he's playing with a sort of maturity and leadership you expect from, you know, someone well in their 20s. So and he has an amazing creativity and ability to pick out a pass. That's that's something, you know, you can you need at every level pretty much. So I doubt that we'll see him in a big club and basically becoming a little younger version of Eden Hazard that we all already know quite well.
Interesting. Is there I'm trying to think of a good word to whatever. Never mind. That's not a good question. Right now, the main clubs in Belgium, what kind of support do they, you know, bring to a match? Are we talking 30,000 people? Or I mean, what? And let's say in Champions League, do people expect these teams to compete? Because I know Anderlecht right now is not doing so well in Champions League. But is that a big deal in the Belgian media? I mean, is that something that people are disappointed about, or is that just expected?
No, it's definitely been a slight disappointment, particularly with Anderlecht, because obviously they didn't expect to win the group. Obviously, they're in the group with Paris Saint-Germain, who are obviously expected to win that group. But I think they were expected to do better than what they have, particularly at home to Olympiacos. That was a game that I think hurt them a lot. They were dominant, they played really well, but they ended up losing 3-0. And I watched the game and I still don't know how that happened. But the thing with Anderlecht as well is they have a terribly young side. I think they have the youngest average the youngest average age in the Champions League this year. So as with other Belgian clubs and other Belgian talents, they are still learning, and it's a big, big step for them. They played a player called Yuri Tielemans, who's born 7th of May 1997. He started against Olympiacos and Benfica. I mean, that's so ridiculously young. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
So obviously, people take that into consideration as well when they look at their expectations and look at how they've done. They play some really young players who are still learning, and you know, as a 16-year-old, suddenly you're playing next to Ibrahimovic and Cavani. I mean, it must be absurd.
Yeah, I mean, the 3 years ago, these kids are not even in high school yet. Now, it's amazing. I think if we get anything out of this interview, is that people should understand that this league might be, you know, the best league in the world for maturing talent and getting players ready. And this is the question that I was most excited to ask you. With everything we've talked about in the last 10 minutes, is it a disappointment for the Belgian fans? You get, you know, you play these guys and they're 16, 17, 18, and then they wave their hand and go, okay, we're leaving now. We're going to Chelsea. We're going to Everton. We're going to Manchester United. We're going, you know, is it a disappointment to the fans of the league that these guys don't even stay past age 20? Because let me give an example. In Israel, for example, we have a lot of great players. Most of our national team plays in Europe, all across Europe. But at the same time, these guys still play in Israel till they're 25 or 26 or 23 or 22. But is it disappointing to the Belgian fans that their stars leave at age 19, leave at age 20, and by the time they're 23, it was almost as if they weren't in Belgium for a decade? Is that disappointing to the league, and does that hurt the competition in the league? Or is it just every few years more 16-year-olds keep coming up?
Yeah, exactly. I think it's pros and cons, really. It's obviously, it hurts when you support a team and then, you know, your biggest 20-year-old talent goes for a bigger club or a bigger league. Obviously, that's always going to be painful. And there's obviously also fans who don't see it as in, well, that just means another 16-year-old can come up. Because there's never a guarantee for that. And obviously, it does hurt. But on the other hand, they also know that, you know, the Belgian league isn't among the biggest in Europe. And it probably never will be, because it's just, you know, they don't have the financial backing. It's not as popular to watch. It is big, but just below sort of the top five. And many Belgians still think it's fun to watch you know, Belgian players abroad. It's a bit like me from Norway. We still like to see, you know, Norwegian players abroad. Sadly, there's not that many of them these days, but we still like to follow them. And which is a bit sort of, it's not exactly the same, but it's a bonus as well to be able to see, you know, your Belgian players and then be able to see, for example, oh yeah, I watched that guy when he was 18.
Right.
You know, he played for my club when he was 18, and he was so good. Right, and, so, you know, and then sort of be able to sort of approach the sort of more hipster, football hipster approach and say, like, yeah, I knew him when he was 18.
Right. So let me ask you, why is it that so many 16-year-olds are, I mean, it's been being called right now the golden generation right now, this team right now that's, you know, the Belgian national team, which is of guys that are 20, 22, 23, 21. I mean, I know this is a question you might not be able to answer, but how did this suddenly happen? I mean, we've seen Belgium do well in world football stages. I believe they came in fourth in 1986 or might make, I think they've done well.
Yeah, fourth in 86, yeah, okay. And third in 72.
Right. So, I mean, that's pretty damn good. So, but what is it about this generation? I mean, how did this happen? I mean, is it the youth system right now? Is it the youth system's really developing these kids at age 10, 11, 12? Is it just a lucky break for the people of Belgium? Is it, how would you explain, you know, just looking at the Belgian national team, you just, first of all, you don't know that all these guys are Belgian. You forget, because, and then you see it and you, oh my God, they also have him. They also have him. I mean, it's amazing. So how do you explain it?
Yeah, well, you have to go back about 10 years' time after they hosted the Euros, and it didn't go very well. And they sort of sat down and decided, and they implemented certain rules for club teams in every area of the country, how everyone had to sort of implement the same system. They're all players, sort of flexible for the system, so that if a player moves one club to another or goes up, he doesn't have to think about his role in the team, because that's the same everywhere you are. And they adapted to schools so that they could play, so the talents can sort of still get an education, but it didn't affect their development as a footballer, as well as the development as a footballer didn't affect, you know, their education. And everyone sort of started working together with these targets, and you know, the result is what we see today. Fantastic, fantastic players in every element of the team, and that's how it basically started. That they, everyone sat down and said, "Well, we need to do something," and they did, and they managed to do it.
Yeah, I mean, they dominated their World Cup draw. Though you could argue that it wasn't really the best draw. Croatia and Serbia are usually, you know, they didn't really play that well, in my opinion, especially Croatia. I thought they played really poorly, but still, Belgium, 26 points out of 10 matches. That's you know, 26 out of 30 points. That's pretty amazing. No losses in the campaign either, which I think they're one of only a few teams to do that. Let's finish off and talk about some of the bigger clubs right now in Belgium. A big story. I got to watch a great documentary-ish type of story about. And again, tell me if I'm pronouncing this wrong, but Genk, because they played Maccabi Haifa, an Israeli team, in 2011-2012. And Maccabi Haifa wanted to make it to the group stages of the Champions League, but they beat us in dramatic fashion. So I started reading more about this team, and it seems like they're now playing in Europe every single year. So I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about this team and what we should expect from them, and whether they're going to be a dominant team in Europe for years to come.
Well, the thing with Genk is they're quite interesting to watch. They have one really, really good striker. His name is Jelle Vossen, and he's been there, I think, all his career. He's born in 1981. He's the captain. He's a really, really good player. And they also have a very, very strong defence. They have an amazing goalkeeper, and they're very tight. I watched the game against Dynamo Kiev when they won this year in Europa League. They won 1-0 away, and they were under pressure constantly throughout the game, and they still managed to ride every storm off and get away with a win. So it's one of those teams that have good morals, and they work very, very hard, and they keep... Also, they keep developing young players as well. So they're one of those teams that I think can keep on playing in Europe for quite some time. And you can also see they have a bit of European experience. They're the only Belgian team that's actually done done well in Europe this year. They have 7 points in 3 games, whereas the rest, Anderlecht, Zult and Standard, have 0, 1, and 1 point respectively. So that, you know, they obviously have something exciting and a bit of European experience to help.
Interesting. And what about Club Brugge? What can you tell us about them and their future?
Well, they have been struggling lately, Club Brugge. They had, on Saturday, they had their training disrupted with about 100 to 150 fans coming to storm the training to mark how unhappy they are with how things are going. They've already sacked one manager this year with a new coming in without much change and improvement. So they are a bit under pressure these days, Club Brugge, because they have a very, very demanding fans, very good fans, but very demanding, and they expect them to be one of the best teams in Belgium, and they haven't been so far this year, and so they're struggling a bit.
Yeah, I see that they've won 13 championships, but they haven't won since 2005. That's a long span, and it seems like they've come in second place 20 times, which is that's tough. That's tough to deal with as a fan. So
always a bridesmaid.
What's that?
Yeah, always a bridesmaid.
Yeah, and let's finish with Anderlecht, which we spoke a little bit about at the start, but let's finish with them. They're right now in the Champions League. They're struggling, but how are they doing domestically in Belgium?
Sorry, that was my phone going off. Anderlecht have been they've been doing quite well. They've been struggling a bit recently as well, with the manager rotating the players quite a lot. The starting 11s trying to compete on both fronts. As I said earlier, they have one of the youngest teams in the Champions League. They have some very, very exciting young players, and I think the manager is struggling somewhat as to how much to play them. They're obviously inexperienced. They might not be able to play as many games in a row as a 25, 26, 27-year-old. So he's trying to rotate the squad, and so far it hasn't quite been successful. They have obviously, as we talked about, not done really well in the Champions League, and they're not top in the Belgian League, which the fans also expect them to be. But they expect them to be one of the best teams there, and they won last year, so obviously the pressure is on them. Having said that, they've lost the top goal scorer and one of the best strikers now, Suarez. He's out with a ligament injury probably for the rest of the season. So they do have some issues to sort out, but there's no doubt that they are a very exciting team to watch in the future with so many young players. And also they've got Yuri Tielemans, the guy that I mentioned earlier, who was born in 1997, and Despriet, who's an attacking midfielder, only 19 as well, I think, who has been forced to take on a lot of responsibility when it's been going poorly this year. So it will be interesting to watch, but there's no doubt that the players will grow on it in the long run, I think, and they will definitely be a title challenger. They always will be.
Yeah, they've won 32 Belgian First Division Championships, 2012, 2011, 2009, 2006, 2005. So it seems like they're the team who's really done, who's really dominating the league. Before we go, please tell everyone where they can check out your work and maybe tell us a little bit more about Football Radar, because it seems to be a very cool organization that no one knows that much about.
Yeah, it's you can easily check it out on the Football Radar's Facebook page or follow the analysts on Twitter. We cover an insane amount of leagues around in Europe and in the world, also like Japanese League 1 and 2. We're starting to cover Australia, Argentina, Brazil, America, the MS. And what we do is basically we cover every league extensively, watch every game possible, follow every player with injuries, updates, and gather statistics for every game, for every team, and to make as thorough picture of the team and the players as possible.
And how exactly did you get involved?
It was one of those that you just sit around on Twitter, and suddenly I just stumbled upon this Football Radar account, and they had an opening, and I applied, and I got the job.
Okay.
Yeah, I've been there since. It's very random, but, you know, that's how it happens, really.
And the statistics that come out of all these matches, are they available to the public, or is it something that clients buy, or how exactly does it work?
Yeah, that's not available to the public. That's for the clients who buy our product. It's for them. What they do, I'm not quite sure, to be honest. But that's not. Obviously, we have blogs. We have insight in that kind of way, and obviously, Twitter conversations. We're always happy to help and answer questions and everything like that. So at the moment, I'm actually working on a blog with the 10 biggest Belgium talents. So
that'll
be out quite soon. So
very cool.
Be an interesting read.
Yeah, you should definitely send me the link when it's up, because I'd like to read about that. Thank you very much for joining us. I know this interview is more of a, kind of a 101 about the Belgian League. I hope next time you come on, we can really dissect the league much deeper and talk about how the teams are doing and talk about upcoming fixtures and so on. But for this interview, I just wanted people to just learn more about the league in case they didn't know that much. And I really enjoyed having you on, and I appreciate your time.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. Thanks very much. I really enjoyed myself.
Okay, thank you. Have a good day.
You too, mate. Thanks very much.
That was Diederik from Football Radar examining the Belgian League. A lot of exciting stuff there. Belgian football is definitely on the rise. As promised earlier when we spoke with James, we said Christan would join us later in the program. And it's my pleasure to welcome on Christan Hanas from ESPN. Christan, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely. And we had a blast with James talking about the EPL, and we're going to finish it up now and start off with Chelsea. You wrote an interesting article for ESPN. Newcastle's really been in poor form. We saw them lose to Sunderland I guess it was last weekend. Very surprising match here. Didn't really see that much from the starting 11 that Mourinho put on the pitch, as well as the substitutions he made. What exactly happened in this match? I mean, for those who didn't read your article.
Well, basically, Alan Pardew decided to do something I've seen him do quite often with big teams, and when he's got congested fixtures. He sat very deep with a very regimented 4-4-2 and demanded that Chelsea break them down. Now, the problem there was that there wasn't a great deal of space for the defence of Chelsea and the midfield of Chelsea to interchange passes. So it cast David Luiz as the archetypal creator. And as wonderfully gifted as he is with his feet, it's a big ask to be able to play such precise passes over such a long distance. And credit to him, he tried, but unfortunately there wasn't really a great deal of success from it. He came very close, but again, even his attempts that came close were picked off. And then as the time wore on, it hit the hour mark, and that's the point at which Newcastle tend to unfurl themselves on the opponent with this tactic. And it hasn't worked in the past. They went against Benfica last season, but this time it did, and it was a case of deja vu for Chelsea, given that they were quite comprehensively beaten in February when they visited St. James's Park.
Let me ask you about the quote after the match that Mourinho made, which caused a lot of controversy, whatever word you want to use. I thought it was pretty funny. I made 11 mistakes is my feeling when my team plays so bad. That's exactly what he said. What are your thoughts about this? He didn't even specifically target out specific players. He pretty much just, why not blame the whole team? Do you think that really every player played that poorly?
I think it was funny to see him take that approach, because I think the Mourinho of years gone by would have done anything but blame his own players.
Right.
I don't think 11 is quite right. I think realistically the three playmakers he chose didn't quite work. The fact that you had Hazard, Mata, Oscar in there, and there was only really Hazard who had any joy, and that was because he could run with the ball and carry it. I think he brought Schürrle on, he brought Willian on, and there was a distinct change in their ability to not only pin Newcastle back rather than let them sit back, but also get a bit of penetration and get the ball into the box. I think 11 mistakes, as I say, is a bit drastic. I think there was two mistakes that he rectified mid-game, but by the time he brought Schürrle and he brought Bilyan on, they were already a goal down. The game had become stretched to the point of it being like a cup tie. And it meant that Remy and Gouffran and the players who had a bit of pace about had acres of space to run into, which is it's not exactly what you want.
And what does this mean for Pardew? There's been a lot of talk about maybe this might be the end for him, maybe not. You know, he's had very, very good seasons with Newcastle. 2 years ago, even, what was it? They were battling for a top five finish towards the end of the season. I want to talk about Cissé. What do you think has been going on with him? We remember, what was it? Was it 2 years ago, a year ago, where he had 12 goals and 13 fixtures or something like that? There was so much hype about him. Then I remember Senegal said, please, can we have him for, I think it was the African Cup of Nations, or maybe it was the Olympics, I'm just forgetting now. And Newcastle said, no, we want to keep him fresh, we want to keep him fit. It seems like since that specific time, he hasn't lived up to the hype. So I know that you cover Newcastle extensively, so I was wondering if you could kind of explain it from watching him play every week, what exactly has been going on with him and why we haven't seen the same Cissé that we saw, 2 years ago.
Well, as you rightly say, he started out brilliantly. I think it was 13 and 14, or it was basically a goal a game in his first 6 months. And again, as you also said, the issue with Senegal, they wanted him to play in a friendly. Newcastle said he was injured. And there was a huge amount of miscommunication to the point where he was actually banned on the day of the game, officially. So they had to name a different striker. It was against Swansea, I think. They subsequently lost the game. So there was an element of even greater frustration there, because he could have changed the tide of things. But I think that it's a twofold issue. I think from a personal level, his confidence isn't there. You can see it in the way that he plays and the things that he does. He's not as as strong in self-belief as he was in the first 6 months. I think he was far more carefree and just approached the league with a kind of freshness to him that he was coming from a different place. And I think tactically, he's not receiving the ball in the way that he used to get it in that first 6 months. If you look at his goals, the 13 that he scored in that period, so often he's facing the goal, he's given the ball either into feet or simply onto his head. I haven't seen him take more than one touch before scoring a goal. He's not someone who's going to pick it up on the edge of the box, like, say, Remy, for example, shift it left, shift it right, and then shoot. He's incredibly reactionary. And again, he is someone who I think will always frustrate you, because he will quite easily do the sublime, and yet the simple seems to evade him with regularity. And that's perhaps not what you want from a number nine. But if he gets the 15 to 20 goals he's supposed to get the season, I guess you can't truly complain. But as I say, the problem is that under this new tactical shift, the striker needs to do more than he can. His technique isn't the best, and he doesn't contribute enough as a target man type. He doesn't really hold it up well. He's not the strongest. And so when the ball's not being given to him in those positions in the same way, in fact, I think Newcastle played a 4-4-2 at times. They did try a 4-3-3, but it was with the striker in there as well. And Gouffran isn't the same as Barr, and the two don't work out as well. So it means that he's not getting the chances, and when he is, I think the fact that his confidence is so low is causing him to fluff them.
Yeah, so far only one goal he scored in the League Cup. Played pretty much every match in the league. So, well, we'll see what happens. Very exciting player to keep an eye on, and hopefully he'll be able to bring back the 2011-2012 form, where you're at 13 goals and 14 appearances. Let's move on now from that match and talk about Liverpool. And our last guest said, James McNichol said, that he thinks that from Arsenal's victory this past weekend, Liverpool are not the team he thought they were. Or I'm trying to think of the exact word. They're not title contenders anymore. Disappointing match, in my opinion, from Liverpool, from what I saw. I was expecting a little bit more, especially in the midfield. What were your initial thoughts from this match? And do you feel the same as you think? that this Liverpool team is not strong enough to play, you know, well enough, I guess, to compete for even the top two, top three over the next 4 or 5 months?
I think it's a little harsh to go that far. I mean, Man United once lost 5-0 against their title rival and still won the league. I think there's a lot of games to be played and a lot of surprises still to be unfurled on the Premier League, and I think Liverpool have been one of the surprises thus far. I think in some ways this result didn't really surprise me, because having seen them quite often away from home recently at Newcastle, at Sunderland, I haven't been too impressed with this 3-5-2. I think it puts a lot of pressure on three centre-backs to be really strong in their one-on-one battles. And I think while it does get the best from the wing-back positions, I mean, Enrique, Henderson, who's been put there, even Sissoko, none of those players are defensively sound, in my opinion. And I say that knowing that two of those three are defenders. And that was really where Arsenal were quite smart. They had John Flanagan, obviously, on Sunday, who I think his last game was Blackburn away prior to that for Liverpool's first team. So he was going to be rusty without question. And they completely exploited that to the point where Rodgers had to shift to 4-4-2. And I think even that shift didn't really help them, because, again, it felt like it was pushing pieces into positions they weren't necessarily fitting into. Whereas at least with 3-5-2, yes, those players like Henderson weren't used to playing a right wing back, but he has the physical attributes mixed with a good enough technique to play it. I think that's the problem for Liverpool, is that they're trying to define themselves in the same way that you can say, well, City do this, United do this, Arsenal, for example, do this tactically. But they're not exactly being given much opportunity to blend it and to have those little bumps in the road. I think 3-5-2 or 3-4-1-2, or whichever format you want to call it, I think it's the best one for Liverpool. And the fact that they've now got Coutinho back, I feel they've got the perfect playmaker to sit behind Sturridge and Suarez. I think at home, you'll probably not see them lose many games at all this season if they continue with that, because I think it can really dominate the lesser sides. Whether it can hold up against its title rivals, I think we saw on Saturday, maybe not. And so they need to devise something that will give them a bit more stability.
After the match, I was reading different articles, and it was very interesting to see, and I thought this was absolutely ridiculous, that a lot of fans from Liverpool were, for some reason, tweeting Brendan Rodgers out, hashtag. I'm in Israel, and I try and read as much of the British media as I can, but is there any logical reason that this would have become a trend on Twitter? Because I was seeing it, and I was wondering, listen, you guys are tied for second place. You've had a dismal last 3, 4, 5 years. You've barely been able to qualify for Europe, or you haven't qualified for Europe. It seems like you have a very nice team now. Why do you think some of these fans were saying that? Was this just a frustration of losing a big match, or can you, I don't know, how do you explain this thing? Because I saw it on a lot of Twitter feeds, and I really was shocked.
I think frustration plus alcohol tweet some funny things.
Good answer. Very good answer. Okay.
I think in the wake of these games, it's very easy to find fans who will jump to extreme conclusions. I would argue that the majority of Liverpool fans are probably quite happy with where they're at, because, let's be honest, they haven't been in this close to the top for a long while now, and the fact that they haven't even been this close to the Champions League places for quite a long while now. I think they'd far rather take the risk with Brendan Rodgers than bring someone else in.
Yeah, I think he's done a really good job there implementing his style of play. Let's move on now to City, which we've been waiting for this performance. They made a lot of changes in the summer. They brought in a lot of guys. They haven't been playing that well. They've been very solid, but they haven't been playing spectacularly. And I was, this match, finally we saw them break out of their shell and put up 7 goals and really look strong in all phases of the game. Do you think this kind of victory, Kristan, is something that can help bring back this team and help them, help with their mindset, help make them believe that, they are title contenders? Because it just seemed for a while that They already have three losses this year very quickly, and I don't know. I've watched them play a few times prior to this match, and I just haven't been that impressed with really little things, tactical things. So is this kind of victory able to help the Pellegrini era?
Well, I think they've been good at home already this season. For the last few years now, they've been quite good at home. In fact, it's been away that their problems this season have stemmed, and unfortunately, this game was at home. So, yes, it will boost the confidence. I think it will, you know, pat the egos of a few players that perhaps, you know, needed the patting, like David Silva, who, credit to him, I thought he was fantastic on Saturday. In fact, my man of the match, in truth. But it doesn't quite yet eradicate the problems that they're struggling away from home. If they can do that, then certainly there's every chance that the title could head back to the blue side of Manchester. But it's just sorting that out. I mean, in truth, even looking at their opponents, with all due respect to Norwich, they're in a horrendous run of form at present. They aren't scoring goals, they aren't winning games. And so you put that against a team that has the attacking potency of Manchester City and the quality in individuals at home with the fairly, you know, happy crowd that are going to get behind that team, they're all factors that point towards a significant win. So I don't see this as some huge turning point for City. I think that will come with a significant away win if or wherever it may come.
Interesting. And, I mean, it's interesting that for a while, or not really for a while, but City, you know, used to think as a battle between City and United for who's going to win. They're the, you know, they spend a lot of money. City has all these stars. Do you think that with you know, Arsenal playing the way they have this year, Mourinho being back, Tottenham playing pretty solid so far, do you think that now for the first time really in a while, this is really an open race? I mean, United could still win. They're 8 points out. They could still easily win. So, you know, you just look at it, and United's what, all the way in eighth place, seventh place. Is the league finally open? I mean, for so many years, it used to not really be open, and I don't think that many people argue that, but everyone can make argument, whether it be valid or not, that Tottenham could win the league. I know, you know, it's not realistic, but is it for the first time in a long time we have three, four teams, five teams that have a chance of winning the Premier League, or do you feel, you know, in a couple months, the points, you know, teams will kind of drift away from others and we'll have two teams at the top?
Well, it's interesting. Alan Pardew said Saturday that for him, it takes about 10 games for the league to shape up and for you to find the potential ranges of where teams are going to finish. And I would concur with that theory. I think where teams are now is give or take one or two positions, probably where they'll end up at the end of the season, unless something truly amazing happens. I think of the teams you mentioned, there's only really Tottenham who I can't see lifting the title. I don't think they're pulling enough in front of goal. And I think that, again, much like Liverpool in that sense, the formation he's trying to implement is one that it gives them a lot in terms of defensively. They're very sturdy and very difficult to break down. But on the attacking front, they're almost too powerful. They lack intricacy. They lack delicacy. And I think that's why you're not seeing them score many goals, because that's what Soldado needs to get himself on the end of things. But I would say, to a degree, this is probably the closest you're going to see to an open title race for a number of years when you compare it with what's already been. Because, as you said, there's a resurgence to Arsenal. I think if there's a storyline brewing there, it's how they deal with the return of Theo Walcott, a player who, you know, they busted a lot of financial muscle to keep around. And yet now you look at him and think, how does he fit in this team, realistically? Which of our performing players do we drop to accommodate him, and does it then completely disrupt the harmony and the balance of the midfield? How they deal with that will be an interesting one to watch. Manchester United, as probably many have already discussed, are in a season of transition that seems to peak and trough quite often. I mean, just look at the game against Fulham on Saturday, an absolute microcosm for that there with a rampant first half performance, and then completely took their foot off in the second half and were bordering on mediocre, I think. Right. I think it's a fair comment to say that this is, there's a potential for, off the top of my head, I would say one of four winners. I can only realistically see three of those four actually doing it, but, and by that I'm excluding Arsenal. Apologies, Arsenal fan.
Okay. Out of all the teams that you do think, or out of all the top five, six teams, which team do you think is the most desperate to add a big name in January?
I think Manchester United. Yeah. I think if you look at City, I don't think you could fit another name in there.
Right.
In truth, there's too much talent. Or you've got Stefan Jovetic, who I thought was wonderful for Fiorentina last season. Now, admittedly, he picked up a calf strain in the Capital One Cup, but he's struggling to get minutes when he's fit. But you know, the depth in that squad is ridiculous. I think it lacks a bit of diversity, but there's amazing depth in there. Chelsea, again, it's another story where you think, well, where do they add? The only position I can think is central midfield to replace Lampard, because I think had Van Hinkel not been injured, I think you would have seen more of him, because Lampard, I think, is very quickly being diminished to a home team player for when you want to pick off the lesser sides. His stats are down across the board. His physicality isn't quite there. And I think his passing has never been quite good enough to place him in the frame that Scholes put himself in when he returned into his late 30s. And so it leaves you with Manchester United, a team that frantically tried to buy in the summer. There was the whole Ander Herrera situation where there was fake agents and all this kind of real ambiguity around his potential transfer, and a late bid for Fabio Contrao. The irony being that Patrice Evra, I think, has been one of their most consistent players since that failed transfer attempt. So I think it has to be Manchester United. Where they buy that player is a totally difficult and different question, because they've just spent over 20 million on Fellaini, and I'm not entirely sure why, because I don't think he fits that team at all. His best position is in attacking midfield, despite the fact that, you know, he looks like someone who could, you know, debut for the Globetrotters or something. And yet they're playing him in central midfield, where his passing isn't really exceptional. His creativity isn't the best. And defensive midfield, again, I don't think he's going to give you the Yaya Touré-like expectations that they need and require. So who they buy, again, not really sure on that. But I think Manchester United certainly need to go out there in January and just test the waters somewhat and see who they can prize away, possibly from the Bundesliga, because I think at the minute, if you're shopping for talent that's going to be well-priced, it's between there and Ligue 1 at the minute, with a slight nod to Spain, given being on the precipice of financial crisis.
Yeah, like you, I was very disappointed when Marco van Ginkel's that knee injury, because I got to watch him here in Israel in the U21 tournament for the Dutch, and I was very impressed with him, and I know a lot of people are excited about his potential at Stamford Bridge this year. Let's finish off with this question, because I like talking about Everton. It's always fun, you know, when you bring up Liverpool, why not bring Everton? So how would you assess Martinez's managing this year? He's gotten a lot of acclaim for it. Would you agree with that?
To a degree. I mean, they've been brilliant at home. I think that was perhaps the biggest credit you could give Tottenham on Sunday, was that, you know, they went to Everton, who I think is 1-3. I think they'd won all three of their games and drawn one prior to Tottenham arriving, scored six, conceded three. But again, he's been good in the transfer market. His first few forays, I wasn't too sure. I felt as if he was, you know, taking the easy option with Alcaraz and Joel and Kone, players he all knew. And yet, ironically, none of them have really had a significant impact on the season. Kone can't seem to score. Alcaraz hasn't really been on the pitch. And Joel is, I think, going to be rightly so back up to Tim Howard. His star signings have been the ones that he's only got temporarily, unfortunately. I take that back slightly. I think McCarthy has been impressive. But the guys like Barry, De La Feo and Lukaku, all very good signings, but again, all have to leave in the summer. Now, I would imagine you can convince City to sell Barry.
you certainly will not convince Chelsea to sell Lukaku.
Right.
And again, same with Deulofeu. From what you can gather, he's highly rated in Barcelona, so there's no reason for them to sell a talent that could very easily thrive in La Liga. So it's almost a flip perspective depending on how you perceive it. You credit him for being able to explore his contacts and getting those players like as the ones we mentioned, but you also have to question, well, where's the long-termism there? Now, that's partly due to the fact that Everton, as is much publicised, don't have money. It's in short supply there due to Bill Kenwright's situation, and he's tried to rectify it, but he hasn't been able to. Tactically, I think they've improved a great deal from under Moyes. I always felt as if when Moyes was presented with a big opportunity against a big side, he was quite negative and quite regressive in that sense, whereas Martinez is quite happy to implement his strategy whoever turns up at Goodison, and I think that's why you've seen such good early season form from them. I think that it's great to see, because again, for so long we speculated on this idea of, well, if he had better players, they'd do better, and so far he's proven right. I think if he can get them up to that next tier, that sixth, fifth place, then he's proved any potential doubters wrong. I think the issue for him comes in how he deals with those next big tests. He's passed one already with that victory over Chelsea, but moving forward, when you have to go away to places, that's when you will find out just where Martinez is at. Because at the minute, he's been really blessed with the fact that his team hasn't had significant injuries. Bar Morales, who in truth has been quite injury prone since he arrived at Everton, and hasn't had an effect on the team's dynamic. But other than that, he's had his good shades of fortune as well, I think.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting how you mentioned how a lot of the star players right now are in fact players on loan that they might not be able to keep, and that, you know, for a fan of Everton, that's very concerning because you don't really know the future of the club. It's almost as if, okay, you can be very happy about this year, but then what about next year? And that's kind of alarming. So we'll see what he'll be able to do. Thank you very much, Cristiano. It was an absolute pleasure having you on. Before we go, can you let people know where they can check out your work and how they can follow you on Twitter?
Yeah, ESPNFC is where I tend to do most of my ramblings. But on Twitter, I'm at KHENEAGE. So feel free to ask questions, pass comment, whatever. I'm more than happy to talk football with anybody.
All right. Thank you very much, Cristiano. Have a great day and enjoy the football this week. A lot of great Champions League action going on, and some Europa League if you're into that. All right, see you later. Bye.
Bye.
All right, thank you, Cristan. That was Cristan Hinaj from ESPN FC. And now is my special, very excited to finally have on an Israeli guest on the program. So from Israel's leading newspaper, Yisrael Hayom, we are welcome to have on Evitar Lang, who is joining us. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hi, how are you?
Well, it's I always talk about Israeli football on the show, so it's really great to have a guest on. And we had a segment earlier about Belgian football and Israelis that are playing in Belgium. But right now, let's just talk about Israeli football. And for those who don't know anything about it, how would you describe Israeli football? What would be the best way for you to talk about the league and the kind of players we have here in Israel and the kind of players that we send off to Europe?
At this moment, while we're talking, I think the best, I don't know how to call it, the best way to call for the Israeli league is a monopole. It's one team which lead the table, Maccabi Tel Aviv, showing abilities that no team can show, and it seems that she will go all the way again.
Yeah, I mean, last year they dominated the league. They had Garcia right now, who is the manager at Brighton. Do you think that Maccabi Tel Aviv, the managerial position, is it a prestigious position to have in the smaller teams in Europe? I mean, obviously not the Premier League, La Liga, you know, Bundesliga, but is it a good position to have if you're a manager looking to be in charge of a very professional organization that really cares about winning?
Well, I think that, you know, it's something that developed in the last year that, as you said, Maccabi became a team that exactly can be like a step up for coach that want to go for the higher levels, to coach in higher levels in Europe. Maccabi can be the step for that. And I think that, you know, now with the new management, the owner, Mitch Conner from Canada, which invents a lot of money, and he brought Jordi Cruyff, you know, for the professional side. And I think that all the organization now in Maccabi, it's very professional, most of any other teams in Israel by far. And I think that it can be step up for any coach who will be here in Maccabi Tel Aviv at this time.
Interesting. And let me ask you this. We all remember, I mean, for all European fans that are big football fans and enjoy European football, Maccabi Haifa used to be a very, I don't want to say dominant team in Europe, but they used to have very good teams. They, of course, Shock, Manchester United, 12, 13 years ago. They used to be a very, very good team. What exactly has been going on with them lately? Why haven't we seen them in Europe, and why haven't we seen them succeeding? I know they're in Europe right now, but why haven't they been playing well?
I can describe the only fit for one package, you know, as one big disappointment. Because, as you said, Maccabi Haifa is a team with a lot of, a legendary team in Israeli soccer league, which played, as you said, in they beat Manchester United and other big teams in Europe. But I think in the last few years, something happened there. They they not invent the same money that the Yankara Shachar invented in the past, which means that he brings for the team foreign players not in the same level that want to like to remember, you know, in the past, like in South Africa, and you know, foreign players that they came and. It was the foreign players. You saw the foreign players and Israeli players, and you can say, well, the foreign players make the change, and the Israeli players are less quality than the foreign players. Now this is not the situation there, and I think that this is the key point, because if Yankara Shachar, the owner of Maccabi Haifa, will understand and will figure out that the thing that he must invent more money in the team and buy players which can make the differences and to be able to compare to Maccabi Tel Aviv, I think then we can see Maccabi Haifa back to the Europe levels, you know, to the Europe leagues, and make you know that they can remake the achievements that they did in the past.
Okay, very interesting. So you're saying that the owner needs to invest more money in the foreign players. Interesting.
Exactly, 100%. This is the big difference between these times and the past years.
Okay. Group F action in Europa League. I'll be there this Thursday night covering the game for some international English media. I know you'll be there for Israel Ayom. You know, very disappointing match in Frankfurt, a couple weeks ago. Now Maccabi Tel Aviv has the chance to come home, and they need these points. They desperately need these points because they have Bordeaux right behind them with 3 points, and Bordeaux will also be playing. So what kind of team should we expect to see from Maccabi Tel Aviv against this Frankfurt team who's dominated this group, has 9 points, the goal differential is +8. I mean, they're last year they finished 6th in the Bundesliga, which is one of the best leagues in the world. So what do you expect from Maccabi Tel Aviv Thursday night when they welcome in Eintracht Frankfurt?
Well, it's a very interesting game because nobody knows which Maccabi you will see in Thursday against Frankfurt, because not like the first game in Frankfurt that Maccabi came and played, you know, very defensively, I can say. And we must remember that they played with 10 players, since the 13 some kind of that. So it can be another story because Maccabi Tel Aviv will play here in Bloomfield with full stadium. I think that the crowd can push them and can lead them for a good win, because I think that Maccabi can able to win Frankfurt in Israel and Bloomfield. However, you say it right. Frankfurt is one of the best teams in the Bundesliga, and Maccabi knows that. But Maccabi has the quality to get the W in this game, from my point of view, actually. And I think it depends on which tactic and which a strategy Paulo Sousa will go for the game. Because I think if he will start with at least two strikers on the front, he can achieve goals. Because once Maccabi play defensively as they played in the road game in Frankfurt, you can see that the players not like to play in this system. Because they used to play very effectively in the Israeli league. This is the main system of the current players, the current squad of Maccabi. They can play defensively. This is the type of the team. You can take a team with offensively skilled and ask them to make 90-minute defense. So I think if Paulo Sousa, we have the courage and to push the team, north, so he can make a win that all Europe will talk about it.
All right, and last question before we let you go. This is a bit troubling. I know this has been a big thing here in the Israeli media. Maccabi Tel Aviv has a really, really big game tomorrow against the second place team, Hapoel Be'er Sheva. Is that something that, I mean, should have that game been scheduled to be played on a Saturday or Sunday? Because, to play Monday on a very, very big game domestically in Ligat Al, in the first division in Israel, and then Thursday to have to welcome in a team, we don't see that very often in scheduling. Actually, we really never see that. Usually a team that plays in Europe would play in the weekend. So what exactly happened here? Is this something that you could explain, that the Israeli league decided to have this game on a Monday night with such a big Europa League game on Thursday night?
Yeah, actually, I think that in this case, the management of Maccabi writes with their, they are very disappointed from the Israeli Association that they made this schedule. Because I think that, a team like Maccabi that has the chance to go up and to develop in the Europa League, the association, the Israeli Association must consider, on the schedule, because you can let the team to practice only 48 hours before Europa League game. So in this case, I think the big disappointment of Maccabi from the association's people there, they are right.
Okay.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah, especially since, a lot of matches here in Israel on Saturday and a lot on Sunday, it seems like a very big mistake. And if we see on Thursday that Maccabi Tel Aviv look tired or they look, fatigued from the game on Monday.
I don't think, it's fine. Listen, we can see that Paulo Sousa make a lot of changes in the first 11 every each game. Doesn't matter if this is a league game or a Europe game. Maccabi has the wide squad to let some players to play Monday and to let other players to play in a Thursday. So I think that Maccabi has the forces to play play, you know, these differences of times and days. But on the other hand, I think the Israel Association must consider, you know, in teams like Maccabi, which play in Europe.
Okay, very good stuff. How can people who are interested in Israeli football and reading more about it, how can people follow you on Twitter?
Actually, I have a Twitter account, Evyatar Lang, as you heard, Evyatar Lang. I'm writing on everything, so I'm asking everyone to join to my Twitter account, and enjoy.
Okay. All right, and I'll see you Thursday night at the game. Thank you so much for coming on, and have
Thank
a good.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.